I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of Parallax Views, the war on whistleblowers, unfortunately, is continuing with the 45-month sentence just being handed down to drone whistleblower Daniel Hill. Joining us to discuss this in a conversation that was recorded before the sentence was handed down is Shadowproof's Kevin Gustola, a favorite journalist of the show who has been on a number of times before to speak about Julian Assange and Reality Winners cases, among other things. Anyways, I want to get right into the conversation. You'll learn all about who Daniel Hill is and what he did on this edition of Parallax Views. And with that being said, let's get right to the conversation with Kevin Gustola. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Journalist Kevin Gustola of Shadowproof. How are you doing today in these wild and crazy times we find ourselves in? I feel like the news cycle, I thought it would slow down after Trump. That's what everyone told us. But it's been, you know, picking up ever since.
It's a new crisis every day. And thanks for having me.
So I wanted to have you on because there's been a lot of stories about whistleblowers ever since the Bush years. You know, we had Julian Assange. There are still updates happening with that. We had Reality Winner, who I believe is now out of prison. Is that correct?
She's on home confinement. She's okay. Finishing her sentence, but it's still prison to a degree because she can't. She's not free to leave.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure of that. And also we have the story of Daniel Hill. And I have to be honest,
Daniel Hill,
I really haven't heard much about Daniel Hill. So what's the story on him? Who is Daniel Hill for those who haven't heard of him before?
Yeah, Daniel Hale is an Air Force veteran. He was involved in the U.S. military's drone program. He joined the military because, like a lot of people who enlist in the military, he did not have money to build a life as an adult. He didn't have enough money to go to college or to a university. And he went the route of joining the service. He was deployed to Afghanistan. And then when he came back home, he was dealing with the trauma of seeing what it was like to target and kill people with drones. And at the same time, he recognized that he had a key asset, which was that he held a security clearance when he was in the Air Force. And so he could get a job with a U.S. defense contractor. And one called him up. It's called Leidos. And Leidos asked him to join up to work as a contractor. He would be paid $80,000 a year, which is more than many people make who do go to college or university. He is well aware, but he only wanted to go work for this contractor for about 6 months. And then he was going to move on to college with the money he made. So he goes, and while he's there, he is at this agency called the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. And there's a moment where he is pushed to that breaking point where he decides he just can't suppress his conscience anymore. And he is asked after work to join some of his colleagues and watch archive footage of drone strikes, which is essentially war porn. And it's too much for him. It brings back flashbacks of what went on when he was in the service in Afghanistan. And so he ultimately decides that he's going to release documents to Jeremy Scahill, reporter for The Intercept, who at the time was the foremost reporter on the drone program, had the Dirty Wars book and a documentary, Dirty Wars, that was nominated for an Academy Award, and also was doing a lot of speaking about drone survivors. So Daniel Hale reached out to Jeremy. And then shortly after, not long after leaving the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, this is about 2013, 2014 time period, he is raided by the FBI, but he's not indicted. He was not indicted under President Obama's administration. And then several years passed. And excuse me, by the time we get to the Trump administration, you have officials that are far more willing to go after leaks, do not apply the same guidelines or don't have the same concerns as typical Justice Department bureaucrats. And so he was indicted.
I was going to say he was one of the sort of big targets during the Trump years, along with Reality Winner, correct?
So, yes, I would say he represents one of the major Espionage Act prosecutions of the Trump era. And were it not for the pandemic, he likely would have been convicted while Trump was still president.
So what exactly, well, I guess first off, how did this FBI raid end up happening? Was there some type of slip up at The Intercept? Was a mistake made? How did they find out that he had leaked this information?
So as far as I can tell, there's nothing that The Intercept editors or management did in particular, and it's hard to fault Jeremy Scahill for any error in his tradecraft. The only thing you could say, though, is that there was some publicity when it came to Daniel Hale and when it came to The Intercept talking about the fact that they had the source. So the U.S. government could be looking for someone who was coming. In fact, Citizen 4 features a scene, the documentary film about Edward Snowden features a scene where Glenn Greenwald shows Edward Snowden a slip of paper. And he looks at it and he says, well, I hope whoever's doing that is being careful because that's extremely risky. I'm paraphrasing. I don't actually know exactly what Snowden said. But
and that's the Laura Poitras documentary, Citizen 4.
Yeah. And this one did win an Academy Award. This was a widely acclaimed film. And this is while Edward Snowden is still in Hong Kong. He was in the hotel room. And so then at the end of this documentary, there's a clip of Jeremy Scahill speaking to the camera. And he says something without naming. At no point is Daniel Hale named, but he says something. And throughout the film, it's intimated that there's a second Snowden. And this second Snowden is going to have revelations about the drone program. So right there, you could say the U.S. government's already going to be looking for this person. Daniel Hale is at a Code Pink drone summit in 2013 in November. That's reflected in the indictment. He, as I understand it, sat with Jeremy Scahill. He spoke at the conference.
And just for people, just for people who may be unfamiliar, assuming I have new listeners, Code Pink is basically one of the foremost anti-war groups in the country.
Sure. Democrat or Republican, you're going to see them out in the streets. If you see anybody in, I mean, literally, if you see anybody in pink, and you see there's men too, but primarily women, you're going to, those are Code Pink activists. And so they held this event. They flew some survivors or family members of people killed in drone strikes to the drone summit. That had a huge effect on Daniel Hale, and he wanted to get up and address them and apologize and speak to them. And so he was putting himself out there. So to a degree, you know, this is a, without him saying, hey, I'm the source, I did this, go look here, this is what I did. Once you're outspoken and once you're someone who has this military background, the US government is likely to have an interest in what you're doing. And I also think that, let's just be honest, at this point, The Intercept was already under pretty close watch by the US government, having been the site that published Edward Snowden's documents. So whether it's their error or something that they did that they shouldn't do, a lot of people think they burned their sources. But the flip side here is that because of who has turned to The Intercept and the kind of stories they've been able to produce, I think if we, you know, we don't have the actual documents right now, but my guess is when we look back in history 10 or 20 years from now and we're able to get confirmation, my guess is The Intercept has been under pretty close watch and total surveillance by the US government, and particularly between 2013 and, you know, 2016, when Edward Snowden had published, had his documents published, and when Daniel Hale turned, because that's also when, you know, not long after, that's when you have Reality Winner's document, and then you have Terry Albury was a FBI whistleblower case. That was a Espionage Act case under President Donald Trump. He released documents about the way the FBI essentially uses profiling and other abusive means to recruit informants. How they coerce informants, you lean on them, suggest, you know, like, if you don't want us to prosecute you for your, for anything criminal, you must work for us. So at this time, I think what we're talking about from 2013 at least 2018, 2019, The Intercept's formidable and the US government is looking very closely. And you'd say that that had a role in Daniel Hale being caught.
So in other words, you know, around this time, it's very likely that the national security state was, putting up the heat on The Intercept, so to speak, in regards to the revelations we get from Daniel Hale. What are some of the most striking revelations we get from his whistleblowing?
So you get this watch listing guidance document that details how somewhere around, 40 to 50% of the people who are being put on the main terrorism watch list, which also I understand fuels the no-fly list that will impact, has impacted American citizens who are Muslim American, that somewhere around 40 to 50% percent of these people have no connection at all to any terrorist group whatsoever. And you can actually find that in it from the document. He released documents that reflected the different, they call them small footprint operations, kinds of operations that are launched in African countries with these special operations forces. He was part of Joint Special Operations Command when he was in Afghanistan. He was stationed at Bagram Air Base and was providing the tactical support to help connect if they had like a cell phone, they do the geolocating for that target so that the drone could find whoever was on the kill list. And so his documents were related to the task in which he was assigned in the U.S. Air Force. And one thing that he also exposed was it involved this person named Bilal Barjawi, who was a British citizen. I was accused of terrorism offenses. The UK government stripped him of his citizenship. And then the US, because he was no longer, he was now stateless, could launch a drone strike and assassinate him without, you know, feeling like they had done anything wrong to violate, you know, the British government or violate a British citizen, because now he was stateless. You have documents like that. And there's a few dozen documents that were handed over to Jeremy Scahill. He's only charged with releasing 10. What happens in a lot of the cases, the prosecutors won't charge all the documents. They'll take 10 of the ones they think are going to give them the best case, and they go after a person under the Espionage Act. What happened with Chelsea Manning? Because there were 700,000 documents in Chelsea Manning's case that were published by WikiLeaks. So they just take like less than 100 and they say, these are the ones you're responsible for. It's enough for us to prove what we're trying to argue in a court.
I was going to say, if you could elaborate a little bit more, do you think there's a lot of similarities, or at least some similarities, between the case of Daniel Hill and the case of Chelsea Manning?
Yeah, so the poverty, you know, both are young white people who come from a generation that many have joined U.S. military because they want that stability, or they want a source of income. They're looking at it as a jobs program. He's not particularly motivated to go out and fight because of the 9/11 attacks. Neither was Chelsea Manning. Go ahead.
I just wanted to interrupt, because that always hits me pretty hard, because I live in PA here, and if you go a few towns down, there's this place called Greenville, PA, and that's where they recruit all the kids into the military, because it's sort of a dead end town. So a lot of kids see that as a way out. So that hits real hard for me.
Yeah, and so just where I'm getting my information, in case people are wondering, there's a sentencing memo that is submitted by his defense. It has details about his life and what he went, some details about what he went through growing up, what his experiences were like as he chose to join the military, and then what it was like being deployed in the Air Force. Then there are details about coming back home and trying to find his footing. And he went to college. He tried to go to the New School in New York after. Anyways, this kind of couch hopping and not really finding his way, it's identical nearly to Chelsea Manning's experience before she did join the U.S. Army. Because, you know, she was working like at a Starbucks, or, she was doing pizza delivery or whatever. And this wasn't anything that was getting her closer to what she wanted to do in her professional career. So that's why Daniel joined. So Daniel has no interest really in helping the U.S. empire further its aims. I think we could say the same about Chelsea Manning, that she had her own conscientious questions that she wanted to bring. So I see the same trauma, the same distress that Daniel Hale almost identically represented in the case of Chelsea Manning, where she's challenging the fact that, you know, she's involved in work where people are likely to be handed over to the Iraqi government to be tortured. And she's reading through the documents and she objects to watching war porn. We get the collateral murder video from her because she objects to what's in that video. But also, I think she's incensed and opposed to how people in her unit respond to that video and think that it's entertainment or it's amusing. They have no sympathy for what's happening to the civilians in the video by U.S. military forces. So, and that's something I think reflected is, you know, Daniel Hale returns home, and what you see it more in his case because he didn't go through prison and he wasn't as, you know, what we heard from Chelsea came within the confines of a court. Daniel, up until the run-up, his case had more opportunity to speak. But, you know, hearing from friends, family of Daniel Hale, the moral injury that he's experienced from being involved in the U.S. drone program is quite intense.
I was going to say, it's infuriating to me because, you know, it's never the kids of a Robert Kagan or a Bill Kristol that are fighting the Empire's wars. It's always the Daniel Hills and the Chelsea Mannings. But moving beyond that, what exactly has Hill been charged with? And also get into those Espionage Act charges, because it sounds like he's not doing any kind of espionage for foreign countries. I don't think he's giving secrets to the Ruskies.
Right. You know, Daniel Hale he faces five different Espionage Act offenses, but he pled guilty to one charge back on March 31st. And Daniel Hale is, you know, he was charged with obtaining classified information. And basically that is a charge that stems from everything we've discussed, you know, deciding to take that classified information in which he had access and provide documents to Jeremy Scahill. I apologize, I'm getting buzzed. Then there's four other accounts that are Espionage Act offenses. They're things like theft of government property. They're things like retaining classified information. So like if you take information and then you put it on a hard drive and you have it, but it's not on any authorized government pieces of hardware anymore, then that's when you can be accused of committing a crime. So, you know, like on one hand, if they didn't have the narrative that they're crafting, they could just go after you for mishandling of classified information. But we never see that in these cases. There's always like, and they always, because of the fact that the person is trying to expose what they think is wrong and that threatens the national security state, so to speak, or it's a threat to the warfare that's being perpetuated, they go to the narratives of espionage. And the narrative of aiding and abetting terrorists is one that they'll also fall back on as well, rather than just saying, oh, you knew not to do this. You mishandled classified information.
I want to be clear, though. I mean, it's not like he was, in a technical sense, he's not sharing secrets with other states the way, like, say, a Robert Hansen during the Cold War or Jonathan Pollard did.
No, you're right to make that point. The point that you're making is the one that his defense is making in arguing that his sentence should only be, you know, like accepting that no matter what he's going to do prison time, it should definitely be no more than like 1 to 2 years, because he's not a spy and he's not a saboteur. And that's what the Espionage Act from 1917 was intended to target people with. Now, there's an asterisk there. There's an asterisk that basically states that many, many, many of the cases under President Woodrow Wilson, when this law was passed, went against people who were dissenting against World War I. And these were people who were political. They're people who were against war.
Wasn't Eugene like Debs one of them? Or?
Yeah. Yes, yeah. That is a top, one of the most famous cases. He gave an anti-war speech in Canton, Ohio. And the government was actually in real time transcribing the speech, trying to figure out if what he said constituted a crime. So they actually had, at the time that he's giving this speech, they're actively criminalizing those words. And then he was put on trial And so, you know, today we see this happening to people very similarly. You know, a lot of these cases that we talk about, these are individuals who, in the sense of the word, are conscientious objectors. They're people who we could imagine were fed up with following orders by their generals or the commanding officers. They no longer wanted to participate in this work. Daniel Hale writes in detail, there's a letter that was submitted to the court, and he details how he did not view this as valiant combat. This was not something that was honorable. He said, if I was on the battlefield and you gave me a rifle and I could meet my enemy face to face, I might be able to see with my own two eyes, I'm paraphrasing, but he could be able to tell with his own eyes that this person was somebody who intended to do harm to U.S. military forces, who was actually a militant who was fighting. However, the drone strike removes all of that. There's no there's no personal experience of combat in his work. He is completely detached from it. And the way that remote control warfare works, it means that there are people who he's seeing are put on a list, and then they're targeted, and then those attacks can go awry. Like, for example, one that he really found to be traumatic was that they fire a Hellfire missile at a car. It misses. The car is hit with shrapnel. However, the man they are targeting gets out of the vehicle. Then a woman gets out of the vehicle wearing a burqa. And then it's found that the couple actually has two children. And the two children, who were both girls, 5 and 3 years old, were hit with shrapnel, and one of them wound up dying. The one's hurt, the other one's dead. Both of the children were discarded and left by the couple because the couple couldn't take care of them and their injuries and needed to just flee the scene so that they weren't killed by a follow-on drone attack, which we know happens. The drones stay in the area. They do these kind of double tap strikes, where we've seen examples of rescuers who have come to tend to the wounded attacked in places like Pakistan and Yemen and Afghanistan, where these operations are carried out. So it's hugely traumatizing because now he sees that, okay, yes, in my mind, I could be okay with going after somebody who was part of this group if it was only him driving this car, but now it looks like I could have killed this woman, and I killed this child, and we also injured this child, and now they've been left by their parents, and what kind of future are those Afghan children going to have? And that is, that's really hard for somebody to grapple with, especially if they're responsible for finding any kind of intelligence or doing any of the technical work that led to that strike.
So just two more things, sir, and I want to note, I believe that letter that Daniel penned was a letter to the judge. You can read all about that at Shadowproof. In regards to, I mentioned earlier, figures like Robert Hansen or a Jonathan Pollard, who arguably what they did actually could have burned agents, could have actually done harm to U.S. citizens working for the national security state. Did anything Daniel really do cause any harm to individual people?
There's no evidence of any harm, and nor does the U.S. government have to prove harm. That's the problem with the Espionage Act. That's something that your listeners should think about really long and hard. This is a law right now that can be used to great effect to impact people's freedom of expression. It's used to discourage and intimidate, and essentially can be used to harass people who are government employees and contractors and former government employees and contractors, to say that if you exercise your free speech rights in ways that we don't approve, we might investigate you for a potential Espionage Act prosecution. And then now with the case against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, that a universe of people who could be targeted is very real. And in reality, expanding to include journalists who are taking this information, who are talking to these sources that could be and have been targeted by the Espionage Act. So there's no evidence of harm that has to be put forward. The U.S. government will even brazenly say that, you know, that it's not part of the crime. It doesn't matter if harm actually was done or not. If you look at the law, it just says the risk of serious or exceptionally grave damage is enough. So they just talk about the risk. You risked doing damage. And then that becomes all that they have to put forward before a judge. And the problem here is that judges accept this. The courts have accepted all of this. The Eastern District of Virginia, where Daniel Hale is being sentenced, and by the time people listen to this, he likely will have been sentenced to some amount of time, could be the harshest sentence in the history of Espionage Act leak prosecutions. And that court is very accommodating when it comes to the U.S. government.
That was the last question I was going to ask. What are the penalties going to look like for Daniel Hale? I mean, what is the harshness of the sentence looking like? And I know we're talking about it before the sentence has been made, but it looks pretty bad at this point.
Yeah, so it is before an official sentence has been issued, but it's actually possible to anticipate what will come down for Daniel Hale and to have an informed conversation about what the U.S. government is doing to this person. So they have sought 9 years to somewhere around 11 years or more for Daniel Hale. And that's only on one count. It's only on one count of violating the Espionage Act. I don't know that I fully answered your question. As to the other four charges, those have not been dismissed, but they have not committed to going to trial on those four charges. They are basically, there's a whistleblower named Thomas Drake, who was an NSA whistleblower, who told me in an interview that they're manipulating due process against Daniel Hale because they're going to keep these charges hanging over him. They won't dismiss them. They want to make sure they get the sentence that they would like. And if they get a sentence they like, then they won't take those charges to trial. They'll say on the date of sentencing, we do not intend to go to trial. We're happy with what the judge has agreed to give Daniel Hale. So another thing is, if they don't believe he's accepted full responsibility, even though he pled guilty to that charge, because they claim that he did not accept that releasing the documents risked serious or exceptionally grave damage. And so if he's willing to say that, yes, the release of documents did risk national security or risk exceptionally grave damage, they're willing to bargain and knock the sentence down to 7 years and 3 months. I don't know if Daniel's going to do that, but I don't really believe that he should have to do that. It's a game that they're playing. I don't think that we should encourage this kind of game that they're playing here. And yet I believe the judge will probably entertain all of their quote unquote bargaining. Though it's not a very good kind of bargaining. It's certainly not good faith bargaining with somebody who has pled guilty to an offense. His attorneys say we should only get about a year to 2 years. The harshest sentence so far handed down was in Reality Winner's case, where she got more than 5 years in prison. And that was they bragged then back under Donald Trump that they had got that they were able to obtain the harshest sentence in the history of the Espionage Act. And so it's hard to say the exact number, but based on my coverage of these cases and where this is all trending, I would expect to see Daniel Hale sentenced to time in prison of at least 5 to 6 years.
Right, right. And I had heard 7 before, so I'm glad you clarified on that, because that could be at the, you know, bright side end of this. It could be much worse than that. I guess in closing, for people that still don't understand why this war on whistleblowers that we have seen since, you know, I mean, we saw it back in the days of Nixon with Ellsberg, but it has really heated up since the Bush War on Terror. What would you say to people that don't understand yet the absolute, I would say, severity of this issue? I think it's a very important issue that more people need to pay attention to. And I have to be honest, I think other than yourself and a few other journalists, I feel like the mainstream media has failed at covering this issue of the war on whistleblowers.
Yeah. So I have an excellent book behind me. I'll just use this. I'll do a little bit of prop. I'm going to do some props. This is a good book. It's called Crisis of Conscience, Whistleblowing in an Age of Fraud. It's by Tom Mueller. Now, Tom Mueller did a very good, comprehensive exploration of all the different arenas in which whistleblowing happens in our society. And as you can see, when I was holding up the book, it's a big book, but he looked at environmental whistleblowing, national security whistleblowing, corporate whistleblowing, and like banking, people at college and university institutions and fraud that goes there, people laundering their reputations and hiding their criminality through philanthropy. And what you see with this case and a lot of these other cases is it just all goes back to the accountability crisis that we have in this country. There's just so much corruption in our government. The sorts of whistleblowing that we need is the kind that exposes, you know, abuse, waste, fraud, and illegality. And yet those people who come forward time and time again are shut down. They face these cases, or they're told that they didn't do it the right way. They're told you didn't go through the proper channels. You didn't talk to the right people. You didn't take this to a superior. You didn't follow the guidelines. It's wrong to talk to the media. That's outside the law. This is how they get shut down. But the problem is that going through those channels and doing things the way that U.S. agencies advise is a method of controlling opposition and essentially entrapping you so that you do not have the impact that you would desire. It's designed to make it so they never have to address your claims in a way that corrects and reforms that thing that you are exposing.
I was just going to add to that. The great irony of all of this, this whole war on whistleblowers, is, you know, it's these very whistleblowers that are trying to save these institutions and renew their respectability to the public, because why should the public respect these institutions when there's all this corruption? It's actually the whistleblowers trying to fix things. So in closing, I want to give you a chance to let my listeners know how they can keep up with your work at Shadowproof. But I don't know if you have any podcasts still going on, but feel free to plug any of that.
Yeah. So it's been a while since I talked to you, and it's great to speak with you about this topic again. In the time since, I've launched a dissenter newsletter that's at the dissenter, thedissenter.org, and has all the coverage of whistleblower cases that I do on a regular basis, along with routine updates on the stages of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's case and looking at all these issues that we've talked about today. And I still have the podcast with Rodney Kallick, Unauthorized Disclosure. But yeah, it's a free newsletter that people can subscribe to. There is a paid portion, but it's a free newsletter for anyone who wants this journalism that we need about these people who are taking these risks to tell us what our government is doing behind closed doors.
Well, shadowproof.com. Thank you again, Kevin Gastola, for coming on Parallax Views. Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Kevin Gastola. Please support his work, and if you enjoy what I'm doing here at Parallax Views, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/Parallax Views producers credits, which you can get at the $10 and $15 tiers. of my Patreon go out to Gratz, Emilia, Omar, Mark, Nathan, Holland, Martin, John, Brian, and the War Nerd. Again, please consider supporting me on Patreon. This is kind of a starving artist's gig, if you know what I mean. Even a dollar donation a month will help. So a dollar donation, $5 gets you some archived editions of the show and the occasional bonus show. So if you're into that, please consider supporting me. And once we get more people involved in the $15 tier, I'm going to be doing a monthly Discord chat. Parallax Views has been going on for about 3 years now. You are what makes it possible. We get a little bit of advertising money here and there, but let me tell you that what we really need are Patreon supporters. So please, patreon.com/parallaxviews. Keep this show alive and well. I'm trying to do the best journalism that I can, some of which you will not hear from the talking heads on the major news networks. This ain't Combat TV, folks. This ain't Wally George. This ain't Morton Downey Jr. And it sure as hell ain't Jerry Springer, entertaining as Jerry Springer may be. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.